when you open the door for somebody else.
Welcome into the vaccine conversation with Melissa and Dr. Bob. How are you doing, Melissa?
I am very calm. How about you, Dr. Bob?
I am calm myself as well. Thank you for asking, Melissa.
That is excellent. It's great to be calm during important discussions such as this one.
Indeed it is, Melissa.
Indeed.
Okay, are we done with that?
Okay. Well, everybody wants professional and calm.
Yeah, I know. Right?
Hey, until they get it. And then they're like, no, please.
Don't worry, you guys. We are back. We are ourselves, and we're going to have fun and talk about... We're not going to have fun.
You always estimate having fun, like as if like we know in advance that's going to happen. I don't foresee this episode.
This is not fun, no.
This is like as a fun episode, just because I'm purposely going to be very calm, guys. This is calm, calm, calm. The results are in the latest poll, and everybody wants calm. Just kidding. So let me say, we are going to discuss coronavirus today.
Right. And let me just say it's April 22nd, in case people are kind of wondering, what the date is, because...
My son's birthday.
Oh, yeah. Happy That's birthday, right. Justice.
Birthday. Yay. He turned 4 today. Yeah. So April 22nd is correct. However, I have been receiving a bunch of messages just like you forecasted. You were finally right about something, by the way.
All right.
Where did your episodes go?
Oh, yes.
95,
yes.
96, 97, 98, 99.
And then we had another one that we didn't even air.
Which would have been 100. So we had a 6-part coronavirus series that was based on 3 different Facebook Lives. Mm-hmm. And each of the Facebook Lives turned into 2 episodes. And a lot of people were so sad to see those episodes removed. And they wanted to know if we were censored and what was going on. So let me quickly give you my reasoning on this, because I messaged Dr. Bob and said, you know what, I think we should remove these for now. And I'm going to tell you why I did. First of all, the Facebook Lives are still up on my page, so you can still go see that content on those particular dates.
Yeah, and the full, the 3 2-hour episodes are still on our YouTube page. Our YouTube Immunity Education Group YouTube page, where all of our podcasts are posted there. But we actually left them up there. We can take them down if you want, but they're up there for now.
Well, so let me tell you my thinking. My thinking was, and I mean, my thinking might have changed a little bit since then, but I'm still okay with it. So basically what I'm noticing, I'm doing my really calm voice. I'm so proud of myself. I'm going to pretend like somebody's sleeping in the next room. And I can't get all hyped. Okay, so what I have been noticing in our movement, the movement, Medical Freedom Informed Consent Movement, which is the movement that we have been involved with, and that is what has built our audience over the past 2 years, or year and a half. We have a very large audience in lots of different countries, and we do have a lot of medical professionals. We have a lot of different people that tune in. We also have people that tune in that are not our fans, but they tune in just so they can try to discredit things that we say. And often those are the types that leave the bad reviews. But at the beginning of this, I was noticing a lot of people had conflicting views on how to feel about COVID-19, including Dr. Bob, including you. Mm-hmm. And I had a very, very confident stance, I'd say, from the beginning. And my stance has not changed. Luckily, I'm happy to say that the stuff that I came across that developed my belief system on this early on has consistently been validated over the weeks. Mm-hmm. And I don't take back or regret a single thing that I've said or discussed or alluded to on that 6-part series. However, there are some people that were listeners that do not agree with my stance. And it's because they were fearful, maybe based on what the media was, or their own individual bubble or circle had led them to a different belief system, which they are completely allowed to have. The problem was they basically started attacking me for having a belief system that was what it was. And I should say, I don't just come up with opinions. Everything I say is backed by something. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's backed by an expert. It's backed by an epidemiologist, a virologist, a pulmonologist, other physicians, professors. There are people that specialize in their fields of expertise that are coming to belief systems that I feel resonate with me. And those are the things I share, and those are the things I talk about.
Right. And you totally do it that way. It's not like you say, here's what I think, and this is my opinion on everything. Almost everything you say is, this, you know, this doctor here did this study, and here's what he said, and here's some quotes from that. And yeah, you share that belief, but you're really just mostly presenting what other experts are saying.
100%. Right. And yes, I know I'm not a doctor, everybody. You don't need to keep adding that to the reviews. I know I'm not a doctor. I know I'm not an epidemiologist, but I research people who are. Mm-hmm. And I combine those viewpoints into one belief system that makes sense for me. So what I realized is our podcast audience is very vast. Mm-hmm. And while the majority of people that tune into us because they're against mandatory medical intervention policy, there are some in that group that still became fearful of this and thought that it was irresponsible of me to have the stance that I had. Mm-hmm. And I did not want to make anybody uncomfortable that was a listener from that, you know, that really liked us for what we brought to the table before, because I understood this was a slightly different topic. And again, it was new for a lot of people. And I think most of those people are going to come around to feeling what I felt.
Right. And I think people in the medical freedom movement have come around to how you feel now. Like now that we've, you know, had the shutdown for 5 weeks, now most people do want us to, you know, either gradually or quickly reopen, depending on where you live, depending on what's mm-hmm. going on. But I would say the majority of people that didn't agree with your opinion 4 weeks ago are now probably, for the most part, all about your opinion, because they're eager to, you know, help our country recover so that everyone can get back to being healthy.
Well, and my opinion is not just an economic one. My opinion is about the severity of this virus, about how the media is presenting this virus, how mm-hmm. serious it is, how deadly it is, and what are the trends and patterns between countries and between cities within states as well. So it wasn't even just about, hey, we need to open up our economy, get that going. That's one element. But the other element is this really the disaster crisis that the media is presenting it to be? And early on, my data, which again was data from other experts that I found and shared, was not suggesting it was.
Right, except for some localized areas.
Those localized areas might not have been because of the virus, but because of how it was treated or how the death was recorded. And so the the data about certain areas was also very different. It doesn't make sense. First of all, it's the same virus. You cannot have it be super deadly in one area. Right. And over here, it's not deadly at all. You can see a slight variation because this one has a big population and everybody's living close together. But you can't have the types of variations that we've seen. And I've read multiple experts that talk about this. Is it possible the virus is that different? Is it possible that the populations are that different? Or does it come down to how these cases and deaths are being recorded?
Recorded and treated.
And treated. Right. And so I like to keep an open mind on all this stuff early on. Mm-hmm. Is it maybe that deadly, or is it over here? I'm not saying everybody's lying. I'm not saying it's not serious for some. I'm not saying some people haven't died from it. And those people are, you know, of course, grieving the loss of their friend or family member. Right. I've never once said that none of that is true. But what I have really tried to question is whether or not, just like the vaccine debate, whether or not we're getting the whole story on this.
Right. And your position was very much validated once we got those studies on how many people are showing antibodies. You know, the studies that showed 4% of certain populations here. Both studies were in California, I believe.
One was in Santa Clara, and one was done by USC.
Right. Mm-hmm. And showing about 4% of the people they tested showed that they already had the infection. And these weren't like sick, infected people.
Right, not current.
These are just random samples from the population, people that never even, for the most part, never even knew they had coronavirus, 4% showing positive, showing antibodies, meaning they had past infection, which really basically expands the denominator in this equation. The denominator went from a certain number to possibly, I believe, 40 times
depending on the area.
So it basically validated what a lot of medical experts already felt, in that this virus is a lot less deadly on a percentage of the population wise, and it has a much lower case fatality rate than initially thought. It went from like 2% case fatality rate down to
3.4% actually, at the beginning, the very beginning.
Down to something crazy low, like what, 0.1% or
between 0.1% and 0.5%.
Right,
Based on under 50 years old, that's like 0.02, 0.05.
Right. So now that we know so many more people had it, not just double, triple, or quadruple, but as much as 80 times the number of people actually had it, therefore you take the number of deaths, you know, divided by that huge denominator. And yes, the virus turns out for most people, for the vast majority of healthy, low risk Americans without chronic, you know, health conditions, who are not, you know, in the, you know, very end of the elderly spectrum, for most, almost all those people, it's a mild disease, and the data has come back to verify that, and so I think now that we know that, that kind of now is driving the idea of getting back, you know, reopening and getting society back on track. And
well, what's interesting about mortality rate and why it's so important is because that drives policy.
Yes.
Yeah. So how deadly this was presumed to be is what drove lockdown policy.
Right.
This is not just an academic discussion about mortality. We're talking about these numbers and projections and models and things literally inspired the types of actions that were taken across the world and in our country and in our individual states. So when you get those numbers wrong and your policy acts according to those incorrect numbers, you literally are changing the course of people's lives, sometimes unnecessarily based on faulty predictions. And that's been one of the big arguments with this idea of modeling.
Right.
And you can't, I mean, listen, I was talking about this in February. Okay. In February, I had data from South Korea. Which is early data because it was their second, I had data from Taiwan and data from Singapore. So when people can say we didn't have the data here yet, so we couldn't possibly have known, it's interesting because I knew. And who am I, right? I knew because I started looking through data that was already existing based on how these outbreaks had manifested in the early countries. So I think there was data there to find a trend. And I saw a trend and pattern early on. And that trend showed proved to be consistent across the world. So it wasn't like we needed data in the United States to be able to come up with these types of policies and decide. There was data already there in February before we even had an outbreak in the United States. And so I really feel like that responsibility should have been on our decision makers to look at what we already had and put that into the pot. And I don't feel like they were legitimately acting based on this virus is brand new, because while it was new, it had already been here for a couple of months and we'd actually seen this play out in other places. In some places they quarantined, in some places they didn't, like South Korea. They had a very low mortality rate. Their mortality rate there was 0.6%, and it was 0.02% under 50 years old. So that was South Korea, and that was back in February. So there was enough there to know, hey, it doesn't have to be this crazy deadly virus everywhere. And if there's a possibility that it doesn't manifest that way, then maybe it's not just the virus itself. And I think that's kind of what led me down my road of questioning.
Yeah. And I kind of feel like even though we had those data, that would have been a really, really tough decision for our leaders to make back then. like for our leaders to make the decision that Sweden made, you know, and the decision that the UK initially made, and then they, you know, then they changed their approach. They decided to lock things down more, but that would have been a tough call. I mean, I don't envy our leaders having to make these decisions. And so for me, I don't so much go back and feel like we totally made the wrong call given the data that we had or didn't have at the time. It's really hard to say, because there was, I mean, we saw what was happening in China and we saw what was happening in some countries, but I thought, you know, everyone literally thought it was going to be a lot worse than it really turned out to be. And they thought it was this new disease. There's all this fear. So it's hard for me to blame the leaders or not blame, but to say the leaders made the wrong call given the choices they had. I don't know. And for me, it's not even so important to go back and try to decide whether or not they made the right call. To me, it's more important to figure out what do we do now that we have so much more data.
Well, I know, but yeah. you always think like that. It's just, this already happened, so we just have to deal with it. But I think the part of the discussion comes down to making better choices in the future, and you have to discuss what went wrong in order to make those decisions.
You know, you're very much right. Yeah.
It's not a bad thing to talk about, even though it already happened. It's not a bad thing to sit here and discuss what could they have done differently. How, you know, this is how we improve in all ways.
Yeah, and the one thing we could have done differently is figured out how to achieve some mitigation or how to slow down a little bit without totally destroying the economy, without, you know, destroying your life as we know it.
Or picking choosing areas.
Yeah, you're right.
It doesn't have to be the whole country.
Yeah, because we knew kind of, well, I don't know when we learned, you know, that it was worse in metro areas. We learned it was worse in large cities with a lot of air pollution and poor air quality. I forget when we learned that, but that's really kind of played out in the places worse hit, you know, Los Angeles and New York, and especially New York
and
by
Italy,
far.
Where they have pollution problems.
Yeah, yeah. You're right. Yeah, we do need to learn from this, and that's important.
But we have to dissect it to learn from it,
right? And I had this little family discussion about Sweden and whether or not Sweden was taking the right approach,
and we'll talk about that today. As one of our points.
Yeah. But I feel like one of my family members said, "I'm glad Sweden's doing something different, so that we have another experiment to learn from. We have a different set of data that we can go back and learn something from," which I think is great. We can't have the entire world take the exact same approach to this. We have to have different approaches so that we can learn, you know, eventually what the best approach would have been, so we can use that information to make the right approach, you know, during future coronavirus increases as it comes
or other viruses.
Or other viruses.
I mean, I think it comes down to the bottom line is when you come to an approach on this, you have to commit to it. And that's something that we've seen that works out good and bad. So on one hand, Sweden, the state epidemiologist for Sweden, talks about they made these decisions in January. Mm-hmm. So they knew enough in January to commit to an approach.
Yeah.
They didn't wait till March to make the approach. They were making the approach in January, and they knew they were going to get pushback on it. And he said when the UK was initially also going to go that route, he felt it was validity for their approach to have a country like that was, you know, well known to be taking the same approach. And when they turned around, you know, he said, you know, it was disappointing, obviously, to them, because this is not a kind of thing that you can do a little bit of one way and switch the other way. In fact, what I'm concluding to myself is it seems like a lot of the places that went for that strict quarantining, it backfired. It seems to have backfired in a lot of countries. In a lot of countries, not just in states, even here, is a lot of the strict quarantining, extended quarantining, backfired just for the virus, not even just for the economic hardship. I'm talking about the virus itself, the spread, the transmission, and ultimately their death totals.
Yeah, the strict quarantining backfired in Italy as well. Yeah, it didn't help them out. And countries that did not have strict quarantine, they did fairly well. I mean, was South Korea? Mm-hmm. They're one of them. And where else in Asia? Who else in Asia did?
I think Singapore didn't have very strict lockdowns.
And Japan didn't do some things too strictly either. Yeah, I forget. It seems so like so long ago now.
Well, right.
And Sweden's kind of hanging in there. Sweden has plateaued, you know, in their numbers. They're not going up and up and up. They've kind of hit a plateau.
And anyway, back to the initial comments, I just want to acknowledge, because there were different viewpoints in our audience of podcast listeners, I wanted to be respectful of that and understand that the people that have come here to our podcast have come here to discuss our issues on medical freedom. There are some that felt like I was doing, you know, I was completely wrong on this. Again, I think down the line, they will come to see it was backed by data. And I think they'll probably feel the same way. But, you know, just like medical freedom, it takes people a long time sometimes to come to these conclusions, yeah. like sometimes years to yeah. come to a place that, you know, in an initial situation, yeah. it could be scary and they're not sure. And everybody's telling them one thing and their peers are telling them that same thing. And the medical establishment's saying one thing and the media is saying the same. Everybody's saying the same thing. It's really hard to be the black sheep on these types of yeah. things. And it's ironic because this is much like the vaccine debate for me to be to hold the unpopular opinion. It's not something I grew up doing. Some people are always the rebel. That's not me. But I really felt like we were being told on this was just not right. Mm-hmm. And it's the same way I felt was not, you know, something wasn't right with the vaccine issue and the program, the medical establishment, the program. So I think it's been challenging to be somebody who has to uphold that because I took a lot of heat. Mm-hmm. I get a lot of attacks, negative comments, especially in local city groups. It's like, it's pretty bad. I mean, people basically wish death upon me, like in just the last couple yeah. weeks, all for sharing like the World Health Organization information yeah. or something, you know, some kind of data. But my point is I felt like our audience is what it is. And this is a separate topic. And so I asked Dr. Bob for us to remove those episodes, all five of the ones that had aired and then not air the sixth episode. They're still available on my page. And I didn't realize they were still on YouTube. But I made a compromise. I said, why don't we come mm-hmm. back today, which is what we're here to do.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about this. Yeah. We'll talk about it. In a way that we each get to talk about our own individual stance, because again, we don't completely agree on every element of this, which is great. It's great to have that type of discourse. And it's good to argue both sides of this issue because like everything else, it's complicated. Mm-hmm. It's not black and white. Mm-hmm. It's not like you're either on this side or you're not. There are a lot of universal truths that are happening at the same time here. And so
right.
that's our goal today yeah. is we're going to go through coronavirus with you. And I'm not going to put up those other episodes again. So if you're asking, can they come back up? They're not going to be up again. I apologize for those of you who really found that information useful. Hopefully, if you still follow my page, I'm posting lots of informative posts daily so that you can see the information right. with links and right. sources and stuff. And we'll talk about it today.
And all the studies that we shared, they're still up under our resources. Like I did not take down the episode, you know, 95 through 99 as far as the resources and the studies we talked about, because those are all very good studies.
Yeah.
And your viewpoint and your analysis of the data in those studies was right on. And I like the information. So that's kind of why I liked leaving them on YouTube, at least for now. And you and I can decide if we're going to take those down. If people do want to see them, they can see them again on your Facebook page. But all the studies are still there. And I'll probably leave them up like in our coronavirus discussion, or maybe add them, you know, to these episodes resources. So you'll see all those. There's like 20 studies or something that we went through that were all very good. So
if you're wondering, that's the long answer to it, but I wanted to explain what's going on there. And so today what we're going to do is go through, you know, maybe 8 or 10 points about this whole debate. And we're each going to kind of give our 2 cents on that particular topic. And we, in some cases, have quotes or experts to kind of back up what we're saying. And this will be some things that you, if you again follow my page, you've seen me post some of these things, but it's going to hopefully be all in one place to have a nice, calm discussion about it. And so the first one we're going to start with is this question: does social distancing work? Is social distancing responsible for decreases in, you know, the decrease in cases across different states? And one thing I want to say, if you don't mind me going on this one first, one thing I want to say is I have looked into this as far as the data and the studies, and there is little to no research that scientifically verifies or proves or evidence-based approach to say that social distancing reduces a peak, decreases deaths, decreases cases in the long run, stops an epidemic, any of that stuff.
Right. It doesn't mean that it does not help those things. We just don't have the data to show that it does help those things.
So the thing that concerns me here is when you make a huge policy for an entire country based on limited to no research, I think that's a problem. So whether or not you think maybe there's a benefit to it doesn't really matter because that's not proven. We have a guaranteed loss for a hypothetical gain. Mm-hmm. And that to me does not make sense for a direction you can go in a country when you have our country alone, 330 million people depending upon their livelihoods or their dependence of people who have jobs and whatnot. You cannot make the types of decisions that affect so many people based on a theory, that theory that if we isolate and we quarantine, this is what's going to happen. So my theory here on social distancing, which I just mentioned briefly in our Facebook Live, is let's play devil's advocate and go yes and no. If social distancing works, if in fact social distancing is responsible for the decrease in deaths in, let's say, our state, California, which never really hit a surge, the surge that was predicted never happened. And of course, people say, look, mitigation works. If mitigation works, that means it only works while everyone is at home, inside their houses, not able to work, and our economy gets destroyed. So it only works in that circumstance. Well, as we know, we can't quarantine forever. And as we know, the virus doesn't go away just because we're hiding. So we have to come back out into society. We have to open the country back up. As we do so, the virus will be there. And we will inevitably have a second surge and maybe more. So if it's only working when we're hiding, is that working at all? You know what I'm saying? Because the reality is we cannot hide forever. And we are destroying things in the process of hiding. So in the end, the virus doesn't go anywhere. It's going to come back. Cases are going to come back. And we destroyed the economy in the process. Is that really, quote, successful? Like, does that really show an example of it working? So that's if it works. And then let's play the other side of it. If it's not really working and we would have never had a surge and we didn't need to do mitigation in all places because not all places had had outbreaks, then we can look at the data we're seeing from different comparing countries that have similar populations, the same population densities. And we can see not every country had some huge, crazy outbreak. So there were countries that did not mitigate, that did not close the schools, and they had minor elements of social distancing in play, and they did not see crazy outbreaks. And then we had countries that had strict quarantine, that had crazy outbreaks and crazy numbers of deaths with closing schools, closing all businesses. So it seems to me, when you look across data, you know, multiple countries, there is absolutely not a clear definition of these countries quarantined and they had nothing. These countries didn't quarantine and they had huge outbreaks. And it's very clear that we can see, you know, that this works. We actually have very confusing data across the board and no real data prior to this to prove that social distancing really works, in my opinion. So I feel like you could say yes, you could say no. Either way, it doesn't come across to me as something that is positive or maybe even a direction that you would go again in the future with these types of strict lockdowns and what it's done to the economy. Your turn.
Yeah. So, I mean, you might believe social distancing works. You might just sort of personally believe, or you might think it was just common sense that social distancing has to work. How can it not work? But what you're saying is we don't have the data to show that it works. And there's, you know, like different experiences in different countries showing that sometimes it, you know, countries that did social distancing, it maybe it helped and maybe it didn't help. And other countries that didn't do social distancing extremely, you know, some countries, you know, did good and some countries did not do good. You're basically saying we don't have the data to back up this policy to know that this was the right policy, which I think is a fair statement because we don't have, you know, those data. To me, I think one of the reasons I felt okay about the initial lockdowns, the initial kind of you know, strong mitigating measures, and because I just, you know, I kind of had concern about this disease being new, being uncertain, not new to our country, but new to the world, you know, as of, you know, the end of last year. We didn't really know exactly what was going to happen. We just kept seeing and hearing all these bad things from China, and then China wasn't sharing data with us, and we didn't know what to do. And so there was a lot of fear and uncertainty, and so I think it would have been very difficult for our country, for our leaders to decide to take the approach like such as Sweden did, or the approach that the UK initially did, or take the approach that some of the Asian countries did. I feel like, you know, I don't you know, blame our leaders for, you know, for taking the mitigating measures that they felt was best for us, because that would have been hard to make the other decision. It's like we didn't have the data, so now we have to decide what to do. And because I feel like there's people just sort of from a common sense standpoint would think that social distancing should help, that probably factored into their, you know, decision-making process, even though you're right, we don't have the data. I feel like in hindsight, we are going to learn a lot from this. And, you know, you and I were talking earlier and you said that it is going to be really important to go back and figure out if we made the right decisions so we can make the right decisions in the future when similar things happen. It can't always be, oh no, there's a new disease, let's shut everything down, because that's clearly the right thing to do. It can't always be that way. We have to figure out, you know, what the right thing to do is. So for me, I see these mitigating measures by, you know, slowing the virus down, even though it might not decrease the overall number of cases that we're going to have in the long run. We very likely will have just as many coronavirus cases over the next 2 years, you know, using these measures as we would have if we had done nothing. But by slowing these down, one benefit I see is it gives us the time to figure out how to better treat it. You know, I think our initial approaches in some cases have turned out to not be correct. And we're going to get into this later with, you know, did we use ventilators correctly? And did we understand how the disease affects our lungs and how to support these people with the right respiratory support? And we didn't know exactly what we were doing. And we didn't have good medications at the start. As we learn those things, in 6 months from now, are we going to be much better at treating this disease? And if so, then we can say we will have, you know, by slowing things down, by spreading out all these infections, we will have fewer deaths from this disease. We won't have fewer cases, but we hopefully will have fewer deaths because people we're treating in 6 months from now will get better treatment. And I don't know if that's correct, but for me, that's one possible benefit that we're going to see from slowing this down. That might be, you know, one of the primary benefits.
So then do you think social distancing works?
Again, we don't have the data. For me, some of the silly aspects of social distancing are for people who are well. And I had this discussion, you know, among family members a couple days ago, the idea that there are a whole bunch of asymptomatic carriers out there that are going to spread this disease everywhere they go. And that's why we have to social distance. To me, that is just absurd. If you have coronavirus in your respiratory passage, but you're not coughing and you're not sneezing, you're not symptomatic, the people you're going to spread that to are going to be maybe your partner who you're kissing, your family members who you're sharing food and drinks with, you know, people who are coming into direct, close, very personal contact with you. You're not going to be social distancing yourself from your family anyway. So for me, social distancing doesn't matter when it comes to all the asymptomatic well people. People who are well have no coughing, you know, sneezing, runny nose symptoms. People who don't have fever. Social distancing doesn't really matter so much for those people because they're not spreading the disease. The few that are asymptomatic carriers, again, it's hard to spread the disease if you're an asymptomatic carrier to people out in the world where they're trying to enforce social distancing. Where social distancing would help would be what I call the pre-symptomatic people. Someone who came down with coronavirus, but they don't know it yet. So they're not coughing yet. And they're maybe out at the store. Maybe they just start coughing there. Or maybe they just start having the first sneezing there. And they don't know they're sick yet. And they're, you know, walking around a grocery store without a mask on, coughing and sneezing a little bit. Then they get home. The next day they have a fever. Their cough is worse. And they realize, oh, no, now I'm sick. Yeah, that person being in the store the day before, they're probably symptomatic and spreading it around some. So had that person been social distancing, been wearing a mask, part of social distancing is the responsibility of not going out when you are sick, right? That's kind of part of the social distancing contract. So that's, I think, the one place where social distancing could maybe protect us. Again, I don't have data to support that, but it's those pre-symptomatic people.
But would you suggest then social distancing as employed constantly in our environment, because there are hundreds of viruses and bacteria that anybody could be pre-symptomatic right. for, that could potentially lead to complications and death for some. So isn't that always true, really? Like, and we basically yes. function as a society yeah. that way,
right?
Right. What you're saying is true, but how could, do we apply that to all virus? Do people always now have to go out just in case they're pre-symptomatic with something at some point? Or do you think that would just be good temporarily for this new virus for a certain length of time? And then after that, if we're used to it, you're still pre-symptomatic and could be spreading it, but we're used to it by now. Like, where do we draw those lines?
I know. And I don't like the idea of our society completely shifting now, where every single little possible sign of illness requires you to stay at home, requires you to quarantine, because that would be absurd. And then I think that would be a shame for our society to go that extreme. And so for me, I mean, I feel like I agree with you that social distancing only helps if you are currently sick or if you're just about to become sick. And so I think that's why what everyone's worry was is you're not going to know if you're mm-hmm. just about to become sick. So if everyone starts social distancing, we will mitigate this virus. We will slow the spread. We'll slow things down. To me, it seems like that should help slow things down just on a common sense basis. But again, you're totally right. We don't have the data to show that it slows it down. And now our society, unfortunately, has taken it to the extreme to say everybody, even if you are totally well, even if you've been at home living by yourself for the last month, there is 100% no way you could possibly have coronavirus. You still have to go out and socially distance. We've taken it, I think, too far and too extreme. And the longer we take, the longer we let that go, the more society is going to accept it. And you get you see the looks. You mm-hmm. go out without a mask, people start to look at you funny. And let me rephrase that. A couple of weeks ago, you go out without a mask, people look at you funny. Now, I think it's shifting a little bit. I honestly think when I'm walking around here in Dana Point, Orange County, most people outside, like on the walking trails, at the beach, walking around the parks, walking around the neighborhoods, We saw a number of people with masks like a week ago and a couple weeks ago, but now I'm not seeing a lot of masks out and about when we're doing our exercise walking. We're seeing it in stores, of course. Mm-hmm. And if you try to go into a store without a mask, people do look at you funny. But I think people are starting to get a little wiser, realizing masks are absurd when you're walking out in the hills on a trail. Masks are absurd at the beach. Now, if you're sick and you want to go walk around outside because you need the fresh air to, you know, help recover, you need the sunlight for your vitamin D, yeah, you're going to walk around your neighborhood on the street. Yeah, you want to wear a mask. That would be great because you're actually sick.
But you're not getting the fresh air because you're wearing a mask.
Well,
in all fairness, yeah. You're not getting much.
You're right. You are. But you're right. I've seen people riding their bikes mm-hmm. wearing gloves and a mask. Mm-hmm. I've seen people in cars. I've seen
by themselves.
Yeah, I've seen people. Someone drove down the street in a convertible, you know, wearing a mask. To me, I think if society allows that to become the new norm, then we've hurt ourselves in a very big way. And so, I think people don't realize the danger of that. You know, we all might think it's a great idea now, but what happens if that becomes everyone becomes just too afraid to go outside with a mask? And
well, that leads to
we lose communication. We lose, you know, social interactions. We lose, you know, looking at each other as we walk by, saying hi mm-hmm. and socializing. We can't lose those basic things that we thrive on as humans. We just can't lose that. We can't let this take us there. So you're right. That extreme could end up costing us in the long run. So for me now, the social distancing is really all about if you are sick, if you're feeling sick, I think it is incredibly important to social distance right now. Once COVID is under control and we're just back to all our regular illnesses, we can't let this be the new norm. I think we maybe we're applying it now, but we can't make it be the new norm.
Okay. So leading into a second question that I don't have on here, then that discussion of taking away, you and I talked about this earlier, the viral and bacterial load that we typically come in contact with in order to maintain mm-hmm. our immune system. What is the danger then? So extreme social distancing, you have people, a lot of people essentially becoming germophobes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot of people, you know, cleaning their house with bleach all day long, wearing gloves and masks, being afraid to be next to people, even if you're healthy and they're healthy. There's a consciousness of fear that has now been surrounding the country and the world. And it's almost like everybody's looking for this sterile environment, a sterile environment that, one, we can never attain, but two, is that really going to help us? Because if, just like we know with antibiotics, if you become too sterile with something, will your body be able to fight when you need it to fight? Mm-hmm. And is there a risk? So I talked with you about these two doctors in Bakersfield today that had this great little press conference, and they discussed microbiology. They discussed the need for your immune system to build with consistent contact. And what we have done now in quarantining, as we've taken away that contact, and what they've said is, we are literally going to create an environment when we lift this lockdown and we open up society, we are all going to be more susceptible to disease, all types of diseases. Mm-hmm. And he said, we are absolutely going to see an increase of all diseases, including coronavirus, this COVID-19, right, because we became too sterile. Do you think there is truth to that and a risk to that of not being exposed over these last several weeks? And what does that do to those who already have weaker system? Like how does that affect our immune system? What do you think?
No, I think that's very possible. I'd say maybe not if it was just a few weeks, but if this turns into the new norm and people are not going out and about much and they're not, you know, going outside, they're not catching little cold germs, little, you know, having little fevers. They're not catching, you know, not sharing germs, you know, in their local society. You're right. You're totally right. If we spend 6 months on like social distancing, 6 months on lockdown, especially, you're right. Our immune systems would be completely ill-equipped to go outside and reemerge.
And what happens if you actually come in contact with COVID-19 in that state?
Right. Yeah.
There's a chance that you could be one of the complications that you might not have been with a healthy, thriving immune system.
Yeah. I mean, what do we tell people when you're raising young kids? The more outside you are, the better immune system you'll have. The more you're exposed to nature, the more you're exposed to dirt, the more you're exposed to other natural, healthy germs. The more colds you get as a child, the healthier the immune system you have. The more colds you get, the fewer allergic problems, the fewer other chronic immune problems you have. You catch things like, simple things like chickenpox. You catch other childhood infections. We know that's good for your immune system and it protects you from other diseases later on. So you're totally right. If we all spend 6 months completely free of all colds, all flus, little sore throat illnesses, little things that, give kids even minor fevers, things like roseola that kids catch. If we spend the next 6 months without any of that, I never even thought about this until these two doctors from Bakersfield started talking about this today. To me, that makes sense. Now, we don't have good, strong data to know that everyone's gonna be worse off. But if that theory is correct, then that would support the idea of getting back out there sooner, not extending the strict
lockdown.
Which
is what they were supporting.
Right. Lifting the lockdown sooner, allowing people to go back to work, allowing kids to go back, to school, reemerging and getting some of, these natural germs circulating again, so that as people catch COVID, you're right, they might be able to handle it better. That totally makes sense. It's a very good part. I feel like what we've, if we look back and realize we went too far on this, we did it for too strictly and for too long. Mm-hmm. I think that might be what we end up realizing. I think, we might end up realizing, maybe 2 weeks was a good idea. Maybe slowing things down briefly so we get a handle on it. Maybe that was a good idea. And then the data might end up supporting that. But I feel like we're going to end up, if I could predict what the data are going to show, which no scientist is supposed to do that, but I feel like we're going to end up saying we did this too long. The states that did it too extremely and did it and went too far for too many months might end up having more problems from it. Not just economically. Right. We know they're going to have economic problems.
Everybody's going to have that.
Long-term problems. But we might even find that they have worse coronavirus when it comes back, mm-hmm. and worse everything else.
Right.
Worse flu season. Worse cold season. Worse strep throat. Worse whooping cough. Who knows what it's going to be. But that's a very important question to ask. It's a very valid question.
Yeah, I haven't asked before today either.
Yeah.
I'm going to find this particular section here and see if you guys can hear it.
These are the two doctors from Bakersfield. We'll put a link to the story. We'll put a link to the story on today's episode so mm-hmm. people can listen to this whole thing.
IgG, IgM, this is how your immune system is built. Okay. You don't take a small child, put them in bubble wrap in a room and say, go have a healthy immune system. This is immunology, microbiology 101. This is not something, this is the basis of what we've known for years. What I'm seeing is when you take human beings and you say, go into your house, clean all your counters, Lysol them down, you're going to kill 99% of viruses and bacteria, wear a mask, don't go outside. What does that do to our immune system? Our immune system is used to touching. We share bacteria, staphylococcal, streptococcal bacteria, viruses. We develop an immune response daily to this stuff. When you take that away from me, my immune system drops. As I shelter in place, my immune system drops. You keep me there for months, it drops more. And now I'm at home, hand washing vigorously, washing the counters, worried about things that are indeed what I need to survive. Let's follow the science. This is immunology, folks. This is microbiology. This is what we've combined together. We have 40 years of experience in this. This is common sense immunology.
And I'll stop it there. There's more interesting stuff that comes after that. But It wasn't. It was interesting because I had not really thought about that before. We are going to be more susceptible to disease after a lockdown that was put in place to keep us away from disease.
Right.
And we're going to now be more susceptible to all diseases. In fact, people who have chronic diseases, the people who are the at-risk groups with underlying conditions, I believe will be more susceptible. They've literally been sitting in their houses for weeks, eating crap food. Most of the people are not getting out. They're not necessarily eating well. They're, you know, comforting themselves because this is stressful. And they're watching this media barrage of, you know, fear and everything. And it's making people anxious. It's making people panicky. It's making high blood pressure worse. It's making heart conditions worse. People are afraid to go seek treatment for these things. They're pushing off their non-emergency procedures. I mean, across the board, I feel like we're about to blow. Like we're kind of put ourselves into this situation where we are just ripe for problems. And it's just ironic to me that we did all this to avoid the problems. And we didn't get the problems. You know, the problems were never really there. Our hospitals stayed empty almost everywhere else.
Except for, you know,
except
New
York City. So outside
and
of that,
a few other places,
we've got now a setup, and they go on to continue talking about what's going to happen, that these furloughed medical staff, doctors and nurses are furloughed when we are about to have a surge, not just of COVID, of all diseases because of quarantining for so long. And we're going to come back to a hospital system that is now broken. And it's just the irony is that the whole reason that we flattened the curve was to save the hospital systems from being overburdened. Mm-hmm. And what we've done is we've essentially broken the hospital systems in the process because they've literally have floors that are empty. They have no staff or oftentimes very little staff. And they've postponed all of these non-emergency procedures that have to get made up sometime. And as we start opening up our country, those procedures are going to have to be made up at the same time. We're going to see this influx now of diseases based on part of what they're saying with the immune system decreasing during the time of quarantine, especially because we've been discouraging people to go outside. They've been closing parks and beaches and things, so people have not been encouraged to be outside. They also mentioned vitamin D and how important that is, and by being inside. So again, we are reducing our ability to be healthy and to fight off an infection, and the reason we're in the situation is because of an infection.
Right. I think what's very critical in any situation like this is you always have to be open to new ideas and open to new data, and not be afraid to change course if new data, you know, prompts that. And I think what we're seeing is people that you know, believe a very strict lockdown, quarantine, stay at home was the right move. And they're so adamant about it, they literally basically hate everyone who goes outside and hate anyone who even questions it. They're so narrowly stuck on that idea and only that idea that had to be the right choice for everybody. And there's no way that could possibly change. I wonder, you know, what their mindset is. Like, why would someone be so locked into that? Like, they have to be right. Mm-hmm. And when I see people criticize Sweden for their decision, I almost feel like it's because they have to be right in order for them to be able to deal with this. Like, there's only one approach. They can't even possibly comprehend looking at new data and new ideas.
But it's like vaccine injury, isn't it? It's the same thing.
Yeah.
They can't possibly conceptualize the idea that vaccines have hurt some people. And so they have to be so regimented in their theory that all vaccines are good for everyone all the time. But let me read. Can I read something for you about this? So this is Dr. John Lee, who I quoted once before. He is a pathologist. And really interesting, some stuff he recently said. So again, I read something from him a couple weeks ago that really stood out to me as being very intelligent in his viewpoint on this. He's a doctor. He's in the UK. so what he says is he talks about, you know, social distancing, and he basically says the real point is that there isn't any direct evidence that what we are doing is actually affecting the peak. Other places which are doing different things seem to have similarly shaped graphs. It is only an assumption that the lockdown is having a big effect on the virus spread, but this is not a known scientific fact. And he says, he goes on to say, which I found this really interesting. He said, do lockdowns actually have side effects that could be even more severe than the virus we're trying to suppress? And I think there is clearly a serious worry they could have. He said, it seems incredible to me that we are not equally as interested in the effects of the lockdown on lives and livelihoods as we are in the actual virus itself. He said, I think we are a bit guilty about of being monomaniacal and focusing only on one thing. We are not focusing enough on the consequences that are coming out of what we have done to face this one thing. And he said, but also the fact that lockdown was put in place, despite the side effects, means the government has to justify having done it.
Yes, yes.
In a way that actually makes it harder to come out of lockdown.
Yeah.
He says, because it becomes apparent that the lockdown or the severity of it, because he does think that certain groups, vulnerable groups, should have social distanced. But he says the severity of the lockdown was overdone, and the government has to come in for criticism from that angle too. And, you know, it's interesting because he basically says in his ending, they're going to have to admit that they've done the wrong thing and this needs to be sooner rather than later. But I hadn't really thought about this, that the government, I mean, like you said, you make a decision and now you sort of are committed to it, whether the data does come in and show there's a different reality here. Our government and the media are just as guilty as the public as being hard pressed into their one belief system and not being willing to adapt or to adjust, because our state government, our restrictions are getting stricter in some senses, and they're getting extended longer and longer and longer when our data is coming in showing us this is less deadly, less of a risk. It's not increasing. Our hospitals are not overburdened. You think that our policy would go in alignment with that, but it doesn't. And it's almost like if they were to back off, it would be admitting that they overdid it. And overdoing it means loss of lives, loss of incomes, loss of livelihoods, careers, increase of abuse, depression, all the things that we're seeing as the side effects. Somebody has to take accountability for that if they have made the wrong choice. So instead of admitting it, they're going to go stay in it and still try to present a threat to everybody just so that they can validate this original decision.
Right. Well, but you do see some state governments and also the federal government, you do see them now talking about reopening and you know, creating criteria for reopening. And I feel like on a federal level, they're trying to shift kind of towards that a little bit more, and they're getting some pushback from some states. And certain states, I think, are going to lag behind the federal suggestions, and are we going to see it be like a Democratic versus Republican thing? I don't know if it's going to totally go that way, but I feel like it almost seems like initially our government wasn't worrying so much about coronavirus, and they is it a hoax? What's really going on? And then they weren't going to, you know, take it too seriously. And then all of a sudden things started to go really bad in China and we got really scared. And so I feel like on a federal level, our government talked about, you know, 15 days of a shutdown, right? 15 days to mitigate the virus. And then that turned into 30 days. And now it's going to be even longer. But this whole time, I think they've been more pushing towards a reopening, sooner rather than later. But now we're seeing some states saying, no, reopening is going to be later rather than sooner. So I feel like our federal government seems to be listening to some of these new data, some of these new models, and shifting things a little bit, which I'm happy about. I'm pleased that they're pushing for that. Because I feel like if we had a federal government that was looking at things the way our California government is, I think our country would be much worse off. They would be talking about, you know, many, many months of really, really strict lockdown. So I feel like we do see some shift. You know, they're not going to ever admit, yeah, we did the wrong thing.
Well, listen to, so President Trump, I've seen him in these briefings go, we did the right thing.
Right.
Because if we wouldn't have, 2.2 million people would have died.
Yeah.
So the irony there is Dr. Birx admitted, in fact, our last Facebook Live, I think we talked about her admission that the imperial model was overestimating deaths.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And it was nowhere near that. The numbers are going to be much lower. And that seems scary at the time, but the data does not back it up. The next day, she turned back around on that. And they obviously were getting heat because it's like you're admitting you did something wrong.
Yeah.
So now every press conference from that point on, which was at least 2 weeks ago, President Trump goes, if we wouldn't have done this, we would have had 2.2 million deaths. But there is absolutely no proof anywhere that without mitigation, we would have had 2.2 million deaths.
Right.
This is literally information used to almost scare people into agreeing with mitigation. And I think they probably realize they overdid it. And they cannot come straight out and say it. So they're kind of still trying to hold on to the, you know, the original theory. So you're saying they're opening up a bit and pushing towards that, but at the same time, they're also still trying to validate their decision.
Yeah.
It would be really nice to have honest discussions about these kinds of things where they could just say, you know what? We had the models that just did not show us the right information, but we had to go on the side of safe versus being sorry. And we see the trends are changing, so we are going to adapt. We are going to adjust. We're not going to just hold on to it because we said we were going to. We're going to realize it's not necessary anymore. I just wish that they would be able to adjust these things and realize it could be simple enough as looking at the new data and making a new course, and we don't need to worry about pride and being right and all those kinds of things, because now we're talking about
and politics.
Politics. And it's millions of lives here. And I do think in our state in California, this is absolutely political. There is nothing about public health that's happening right now that is pushing the decisions for us to stay in this level of lockdown that we are still in.
Right.
And that's concerning to me.
Yeah, well, I appreciate what Ben Carson said recently. And again, we're talking about a neurosurgeon. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about someone who's you know, not intelligent, someone who's dumb. We're talking about a neurosurgeon. He said that the media have been overblowing this, you know, ramping up the fear, spreading fear. He said I'm paraphrasing, so I'm not quoting him, but that has done the public such a huge disservice, that by painting this disease as way worse than it really is, scaring everybody, thinking everyone's going to die from it, instead of you know, saying how, you know, everyone who's young and middle aged and healthy without, you know, chronic diseases, for the most part, they're all going to weather this disease okay. And he was really coming down on the media for that. And I feel like that was a big part of what got the public behind the government policies.
Of course, and they needed it.
Right, but I don't think the media were doing it because the government asked them. I don't think the government even had to ask them to do this time. I think the media just jumped all over it like they would tend to do, because they're always looking for something sensational. Yeah, then the government could have played a role in that, because they tend to try to control the media. But then again, some of the media are not friendly towards our government. And,
well, right, let's segue this into the
But next. I don't think any mainstream media was saying, look, everyone, this is nothing to worry about. You know, it's a mild disease for almost everybody. They're always looking for the sensational story. So Ben Carson was really kind of coming out about that, saying things that I've not heard President Trump say, as far as, you know, realizing for the vast majority of people, this virus would be a very mild disease.
Well, I was going to say, let's segue into this idea of the public hate and division and how it has become political. Just because you're mentioning this, I figure we can go into this. Right. So let's go into discussing this idea of the public, the hate and the division that we're seeing, and we're seeing it in the media, and we're seeing how this has become a very political issue. In fact, I just did a post about this a couple days ago saying there are a lot of people that hate President Trump. And I'm realizing that when you have a discussion on this issue, people just want to jump right in on their hate for Trump and they make it political. And, you know, to me, this is a medical issue. This is a public health and medical issue. This is not a political one or should not be a political one. So if you have a dislike for Trump, his policies, him as a person, or Republicans and conservatives, you should not cling to whatever theory somebody holds on the other side just despite that person.
Yes.
This should be about the validity of the theory. And what I'm seeing is if you look at the very liberal news, they're absolutely promoting fear of the virus. And if you go to the more conservative news, they're promoting more of the economic hardship.
Right.
And the secondary side effects of this. So I find that really interesting because, you know, I'm not picking one or the other. However, one is very emotionally driven and one is very business driven. And the reality is you have to look at the actual information, the actual data, the actual business side of running a country. And I don't consider myself a conservative, but I find myself aligning with the viewpoints on this issue more from Republicans than I do from Democrats. Because what I'm seeing from Democrats is Trump didn't act soon enough. He's put us in this position. The reason we're having all these deaths is because we should have quarantined sooner and he failed to do it. He didn't do the testing right. He did, you know, all these things. Nobody's really talking about, well, oh my gosh, the virus actually isn't as deadly as they originally thought. Let's look at these new numbers. Let's look how many people have already had the antibodies. Let's look at the real case fatality rate. Nobody wants to have that discussion. They want to talk about New York. They want to talk about people dying left and right. Before New York, they were talking about Italy. They want to focus on the crisis. And we know that media does this, right? We know that. But for some reason on this issue, it's literally broken down into one side of the fence versus the other in the way that they're portraying how dangerous coronavirus is. And I find it really interesting. And unfortunately, when you have a conversation in local groups, as soon as you mention something that says, hey, we need to get back to work, people go right on this whole like ranting, you know, thing about Trump and anti-Trump and they hate Trump supporters. I'm like, how is he even coming into this discussion? We're just talking right. about data here. And it's unfortunate because it's created a very divisive, very hate-filled. The types of comments I've seen are basically from regular citizens at the equivalent to what I've seen from trolls, paid internet trolls mm-hmm. on the vaccine debate. Mm-hmm. It is bad. And it's bad probably because people are stir crazy and they have cabin fever and they are going a little off from being stuck away from social connection. But I have been very shocked. People in your area, by the way, in this city, the type of hate that I've seen wished on people, I've heard a nurse make a post. She was criticizing people that were doing protests, and she said she would not resuscitate one of these people if they got sick and came in there. And it was such a hateful thing to say for somebody in the medical field. She eventually had to take that post down because she got a lot of backlash saying, you know what, in your profession, I didn't know you got to decide who deserves life-saving yeah. you know, care or not. But the fact that you can be working for the public in the sense that you're a healthcare provider and you can have so much hate for somebody based on the fact that you think they're a Trump supporter, that if they got sick and came into your hospital, you don't even want to resuscitate them. It's absolutely disgusting. And I've seen this with my own eyes. People I know, I've seen the way that they have talked to people and they've wished death on people. I've seen it happen. And I realize what's underneath all of this hate and division, it's politics. Because every single time they jump in with an anti-Trump thing and they assume everybody protesting is a Trump supporter. And they assume anybody who thinks about the economy is picking money over lives mm-hmm. and that we're probably all Republicans and conservatives and we support Trump and he's awful in X, Y, and Z. So it's really sad that a medical issue is not being debated on medical merit. Instead, it has been absolutely turned into a political political battle over those who like Trump and those who don't like Trump, and they are portraying the issue on their news networks differently about whether you should be scared of this virus or whether you should not be scared of this virus. And that, I think, is very irresponsible of the media.
Right. Right, because this is an election year. It's hard to imagine that we're even going to have an election this year with everything going on. But you're right. It's almost like, you know, because right now, you know, we have a Republican president, we have a Republican Senate, and then we have a, you know, a Democratic majority in the House. But it's almost like if we handle this coronavirus crisis well and we get through it well, then, you know, is that going to, you know, raise the chance of President Trump being reelected? And is he going to, you know, shift the House back to Republican? Is there going to be a Republican supermajority? And I'm sure that really scares Democrats. And so people are basically, in order to try to gain ground in the next election, they're basically just going to have to disagree with whatever President Trump is trying to do here. And they're just going to automatically take the opposite approach. And you're right. That's a political decision. And it's interesting because I feel like because the federal government supported the shutdown, and in fact, he kind of locks down things, I think, pretty early in this. Yeah, I don't think he delayed the lockdown, you know, any more than anyone else would. He probably shut down things sooner than some people would have. But he almost took the same approach that everyone would have taken, right? And everyone kind of agreed with that. He almost like we're almost all, except for you, because he kind of took the approach that everyone agreed with initially, you know, shutting things down, mitigating. But now he wants to take the approach that's kind of better for both sides of this. You know, try to continue some mitigating steps that's going to help protect, you know, people who are vulnerable, yet get the economy back on track so that the country can support this whole endeavor. He's now going to be pushing for that. And that's where the politics. So suddenly, yeah, everyone who's against Trump is going to be against, you know, this whole reopening. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, I have a hard time believing that on a personal level, they would really feel that way if this wasn't a political thing. Seems to me like most freedom-loving Americans, liberal and conservative, would want, you know, the citizens to be in charge, you know, to be in charge of their lives and have, you know, self-determination and have freedom. I never thought that was a political issue. I thought that was just something that everyone wanted. Am I wrong? I mean, are there people that really do want the government to like totally control everything? Is that the liberal agenda? Or,
well, it's interesting that I've seen some people are really opposed to the idea of reopening the country, almost like they don't ever want it to happen ever. Like, yeah. People have gotten so comfortable, yeah, with these very strict rules. I think for some people, it's going to be an adjustment, like a social adjustment,
yeah,
to actually come back into life the way we knew it before. Because it's almost like if you put somebody in solitary confinement and they're basically away from everybody and that they almost don't know how to deal with people when they do. And so for some people, yeah, it messes them up forever. Remember, you're in a family environment where you still have contact with people, but there are some people that are essentially living alone and have a lot of alone time during this quarantine. So for them, it's a very big difference from the interaction they might have had. And that's why we worry about these things like increase in suicides and depressions, yeah, and mental health issues.
Yeah, well, think about what this isolation does, not only to your mental health, but also to your immune system. Like we were saying earlier, you know, sadness and depression, mm-hmm, and loneliness, that totally tanks your immune system in a huge way. That's not a small, yeah, effect. We know, you know, laughter, being positive, being happy, we know that gives you such a huge immune boost. And I've struggled with this as well. I've had some sad days and some days where the entire day I'm just down. I don't know why, you know, 2 days in a row. And then I'll have some great days where I'm happy. We're doing a lot of fun stuff with the family. And so I'm kind of like up and down. But think about people that are like totally down,
right,
and depressed, you know, week after week after week. Not only is their mental health, yeah, going to decline, you're right, when they go back out into society, they're going to be in trouble. Their immune system is going to be in really big trouble. And that's a big problem. So I feel like if our leaders looked at every single angle all together and considered every angle of this, it seems to me like properly timed and phased reopening is, you know, not slow. And when I say properly, I don't mean, you know, what our governor is planning. I mean something that's faster than what our governor sounds like he's planning. I think that's going to be what's going to be the best thing for almost everybody, even the vulnerable. Something that I feel very important for people to understand about: the longer the shutdown goes, the worse our economy gets. It's not that we can all just not be rich anymore and buy things. This really turns into the idea that, I guess, I'm a 51-year-old, you know, pretty healthy guy, and if I'm gonna if I catch coronavirus, or if I already caught it, you know, there's a good chance it's gonna be mild. So why can't we use me to go back to work full time and start generating income, so that we can start making tax money, so we can start paying back the government for all the free money they're giving us now. We can start rebuilding the tax base, so we can start funding everything. That's what I don't get. I don't get why anybody wouldn't want our workforce to get back into working, because you got to think of the economics of this. Right now, the government is giving out, I think it's in the trillions of dollars. Mm-hmm. They're giving out all this money to small businesses, big businesses, individuals. They're giving lots of money to everybody right now to help people, you know, sustain this lockdown. They're not taking in any money. You know, no one's paying taxes right now because no one's making any money. So, I mean, we already have this huge deficit.
Right.
And this is incredibly important to consider. With this huge deficit, the only way to fix a deficit is to bring in tax dollars and spend less money. We're doing the opposite. We're bringing in no tax dollars and we're spending tons and tons of money. So if every able-bodied American can get back to work soon, like even like right now, could get back to work, we can start paying our taxes again, and the government can start funding everything they need to fund to help everyone through the next phase of coronavirus, help hospitals and help people recover from the first phase, get ready for the next phase, and then the next phase after that. It takes a lot of money for our country to stay healthy and to treat everyone who has coronavirus and to treat everyone who has a health problems because of coronavirus and to improve everyone's health so they don't have a severe case of coronavirus. I mean, if you have heart disease or a lung condition, if we can get you to improve your health, improve your immune system, when you catch it, you're going to be, you know, better off. If we can change that, that all takes money. And so why not send, you know, if you want to call this a war, you don't hide your armies in barracks when you're at war. You send your troops out there to fight a war. We have this whole army of taxpayers, people that can make money, start paying taxes so their government can do what they need to do for this whole thing. So to me, that's why I support, you know, these people who do the protests. I support, you know, when people are getting out there and protesting and pushing for reopening, because again, for me, it's not that I want to make my, you know, I even forget. I mean, I just making a say I make $10,000 a month as a doctor. It's not that I want to get back to making that so I can, you know, buy lots of good things again. I want to start making that so life can go back to normal for everybody. And my job, my work can actually fund what we need to do as a country to get back on track and recover from this and survive the next phases. So how can anyone be against that? And I think they're against that for political reasons, like you said. They're against that because they bought into the fear. They're against that because the media has convinced them that this is a terrifying, terrible disease for everybody. And people who are out there protesting are wrong. The media is really playing into this. And I, like we've already talked about with the vaccine discussion, I hope that people can start to see, maybe we keep some social distance issues going and some social distancing steps going, whatever we figure out is going to be important for society. But part of that has to include our workforce again, not for individual benefit, but for your own benefit. You who are against reopening, we're only trying to do it for your benefit and our benefit and everyone's benefit. And so that's why I very much would support that. And I don't know, maybe I'll be out there at the next protest. I didn't go to the last one, but we'll see.
Well, they're happening all over the country. Yeah. So obviously people everywhere are feeling the same thing. And for anybody who likes to say that these people are selfish and they're spreading disease, it's like if the next week your governor tells you it's fine to open up, all of a sudden you're not going to think there's a risk now. It's so silly to think that today people are spreading disease, but as soon as somebody lets us out, then all of a sudden it's not a risk anymore. I mean, I think there really is a lack of critical thinking on this. Mm-hmm. And we'll get into more of these issues on part two, because we'll wrap it up now for this episode. And we'll get into part two. We'll talk about New York. We'll talk about ventilators. I want to talk about the Imperial College and Oxford model differences. We'll talk about Sweden, who is at risk, the underlying conditions, who's at risk, and some more things that you want to bring to the table on this, Dr. Bob. And so anyway, thank you for joining us for part one of this coronavirus discussion. We'll get right into part two. And you guys will get that episode hopefully in a couple days from now. And hopefully not too much has changed since then, because the information does change pretty quickly on this issue.
Yeah.
But we're trying to get to you the best information as quickly as possible. And thanks for listening and joining us today on the Vaccine Conversation with Melissa and Dr. Bob.
The information in this podcast is for entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as medical advice. Always consult your healthcare professional for information on vaccines and infectious diseases.